funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? Like I'm a clown? I'm a clown? I'm a clown?
Rosebud.
Yeah, so guys, today we are giving you something that's not French. We had a French director a couple weeks ago. We got past it. We all survived. Then we had an American legend with Peckinpah. Hope you guys enjoyed. Today we're talking about an Italian legend. So, I mean, yeah, we're thankfully we're putting a little gap between us and the French. Anyway,
this is
Jonathan. Jonathan here with Jacob. I am 99% sure you can't do that anymore.
No, you can. You can, actually. Any
Who state, makes these rules?
Any state but New York. In New York, it is illegal to discriminate against Italians, but any other state, we're good to go. So if you're listening to this and you're in the state of New York, you have just committed a crime by listening to me say Mamma Mia. Other than that, any other state, any other country, you're good to go.
Hold on, but who made that rule?
I literally think it's a law in the state of New York, like, because when you apply for a job at the CUNY university system, City University of New York, there's a little like anti-discrimination clause at the bottom. And it literally says, like, please note that anti-Italian discrimination is like specifically, basically Italians are like a protected class under like anti-discrimination laws. So yeah, dude.
Well, that's the way it should be, because Italians are treasures opposed to, well, we all know who. So anyway, guys, today we are talking about a true Italian legend that I will admit I am woefully underseen, underwatched, I suppose is a better word. Jacob, who are we talking about?
Roberto Rossellini.
Exactly. Now he's an interesting one, because he's another one that Martin Scorsese highly, you know, looks up to. He's highly influenced by him. So I should have seen more of his filmography. I think I've only seen like 4 or 5 movies by him. So it was fun to kind of watch more of them for this episode. And I'm going to continue that journey, because right now, I think Fellini has the edge on him, but as we were talking about off pod, it sounds like you kind of give him the edge over Fellini.
Well, you know, it's not a competition, but if it was...
Well, it is.
If it was, I would take Rossellini. Rossellini, to me, is... boy, he's just a hard dick filmmaker of the highest order, in my opinion. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say... The American way is you're only winning if someone else is losing. So it absolutely is a competition.
That's true. So in order for us to gas up Rossellini, we got to take down that motherfucker Fellini.
There's no we in this. I don't want to take down Fellini.
So Rossellini.
It's really interesting. I'm assuming you read what a friend of the pod, previous guest, David Thompson, had to say about Rossellini.
I sure did.
Rossellini. I don't know why I just said Rossellini, like a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's one of those interesting directors. We were kind of talking about off pod a little bit, that prefers to focus on like the ordinary. Like he wants to marry, especially with one of the films we're going to talk about, he marries the kind of melodramatic, somewhat surreal to actual reality going on in Nazi occupied Italy, which I thoroughly enjoyed him like kind of joining those two together. But with the other one, I don't know if he did this on purpose, we get more of the Rossellini who's like, no, this is real life shit. This is a marriage that's falling apart. These two people. And we're literally spending all of our time within this relationship. So there is not a touch of anything but straight up reality in those two. Did you mean for that, or did you just pick these two because you picked them?
Well, I mean, these are probably his two, you know, most well-known films. And, you know, I wanted to do an episode on the War trilogy, you know. And for those of you who don't know, Roberto Rossellini directed the War trilogy, which is a trilogy about World War II, specifically World War II in Europe, obviously. And those three are Rome Open City, Paisan, and Germany Year Zero. And then he also did kind of a trilogy with Ingrid Bergman. Ingrid Bergman basically called up Fellini and or called up Rossellini and was like, I think you're a genius and I want to work with you. And he was like, okay. And they ended up getting married and making three movies together. And Stromboli, Europa 51, and Journey to Italy, which, yeah, I don't know. I just kind of picked the best known of those two kind of informal trilogies and, yeah, went from there. It would have been nice if we could have covered more or like covered the War trilogy by itself, but I didn't want to leave out Journey to Italy because I just, it's such a singular vision. And I think it's the kind of critical tide has been moving for that to be considered maybe his best work, which I tend to agree with, but we can get into it.
Well, I mean, for sure, this will not be the last we see of Rossellini. We will be talking about more of him. But in the meantime, do we want to talk about Rome Open City or Journey to Italy first?
Yeah, I think we should talk about Rome Open City first.
Yeah, so let's talk about Rome Open City then. It came out in 1945, and the synopsis is, during the Nazi occupation of Rome in 1944, the resistance leader, Giorgio Manfredi, is chased by the Nazis as he seeks refuge and a way to escape. I'm not going to lie, this movie was moving, like on a real sense. It's crazy that a movie this old about World War II, of which we've seen dozens of war movies on, which I wouldn't even consider this a war movie, personally. It's insane. It's insane how effective this was. It was beautiful. It was sad. It could make you laugh. It seems like I don't know. Honestly, I was quite blown away.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we should say, you know, Italian neorealism is, you know, that becomes a thing that kind of anybody who, you know, watches movie knows about. Watches movies, you know, they obviously know about, you know, the history of film, Italian neorealism, but it's also like a film movement that didn't produce a lot of movies that are still watched, I guess, especially when compared with stuff like the French New Wave, you know, and New American cinema in the 70s and, you know, even classical Hollywood cinema or whatever. You know, the Italian neorealists, the movie that most people see is Bicycle Thieves and then maybe Umberto D. But that still, Umberto D still doesn't seem like it's a movie that most people have seen. The movie that most people have seen has definitely Bicycle Thieves. And this come out, I think, what, a few years before Bicycle Thieves. Bicycle Thieves is what, 52 or 48?
Yeah, and we actually talked about Bicycle Thieves way at the beginning of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't have the episode off the top of my head, but we literally talked about it like in the first like few months on an Art House episode.
Yeah, yeah. But this is the movie that kicked off Italian neorealism. You know, Bicycle Thieves is often thought of as maybe the peak of the movement, which is, I think, debatable, but Rome Open City really kicked off that movement. And the reason that it kicked off that movement is because the Italian film industry basically had to start over, right? I mean, in World War II, you know, Italy was occupied by, you know, the fascist Mussolini, you know, Mussolini's fascist party. And the Italian film industry was basically just fascist propaganda, right? And the Allied occupying forces after World War II, there's this quote by this admiral who took over basically the Italian film industry and was like, the Italian film industry needs to just be like, we need to just start over. and they actually turned the famous Cinecita or Cinecita, I don't know how you say that, that famous Roman film studio, but they actually turned that studio into a homeless encampment. Like they essentially just had to rebuild the film industry from the bottom up. And Rossellini was a big part of that, and Fellini obviously was a big part of that. Fellini actually co-wrote the screenplay for this. And the origins behind Rome Open City are kind of nebulous. From what I understand, there's a lot of different people taking credit for a lot of different things, and it's kind of difficult to untangle all the different threads there. But the point is, this is really the start and probably the first. I mean, when you think about 1945, I mean, this is only 6 years after Gone with the Wind, right? This is 3 years after Casablanca. This is early in film history. And this kind of naturalism and realism is something that cinema had never really experienced before. You know, I mean, you can say Renoir and some of the poetic realists in the 30s in France were similar to this, but I mean, and we just did an episode on Marcel Carné, but when you compare something like Port of Shadows to this, it's completely different. Port of Shadows is stylized and it's abstract and it's shadowy and it's romantic. This is none of that. This is pure, unfiltered realism on a level that we have not seen in cinema history at this point in 1945. And it's kind of astonishing, I think. So yeah, that's a little bit of background. What was your reaction to it? Just kind of right off the bat, you obviously said you liked it and it was quite emotional. Yeah, I don't know.
I was surprised by a lot, honestly. I was surprised by the effectiveness of it, because I feel like we can watch, I mean, I've watched a ton of World War II documentaries. It's probably the most popular war, as weird as that is to say, mm-hmm. that people read about and watch movies about and documentaries. We've all seen, you know, several World War II movies, documentaries, and it's crazy. Like watching this and with this like Italian neorealism, which he was like, I think he kind of alluded to it, but he was kind of like the godfather of the movement, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, this movie started it all, you know?
Yeah. So when you have kind of these normal people like in the streets and these children running around and these people living in these like apartments, everybody in their like, they are rising to the occasion of what needs to be done in a way. And mm-hmm. when you present it on such a human level, it's really quite breathtaking. And I was blown away by the graphicness of it. That torture scene was pretty surprising, mm-hmm. if I'm being honest. I could not believe they actually showed it. And the end of it hit hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, this movie came out fucking 1945, and the end hit so hard with the priest. It's insane. Like I was legitimately blown away when I finished this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I think it's useful to compare it to something like Bicycle Thieves, and I even did a little meme comparison about it on Twitter, just for our Twitter followers out there, but it's funny to compare this to Bicycle Thieves and be like, okay, Bicycle Thieves is, you know, realistic and depressing and post-war Italy, whatever, whatever. But like, this is on another level, right? Like this is not, I lost my bike. This is, you know, the kind of the inner depravity of human beings, you know, being kind of laid bare and an almost, you know, I was going to say religious suffering, but I mean, you know, it's almost even beyond that, you know, it's really kind of astonishing. I don't know. Let's break it down a little bit, because the movie basically takes place in two parts, which is unusual. I don't think I've ever seen a movie that is, you know, I think it's an hour 40. I think it's an hour and 40 minutes long, and it's divided into two parts. You know, usually you see that for much longer movies, but
yeah, I was really surprised when it said end of part one. I was like, what? Like, this is strange.
Yeah, two distinct parts. I think the first half is I don't know, how would you describe it? I feel like it's a lot of intrigue. Like, it's a lot of the resistance, the Italian resistance under Nazi occupied Rome. And the actual plot mechanics are a little unclear, I think, even after having seen this movie a few times. I think it's unclear exactly what is going on. There's a lot of references to like people escaping and whispering and the shuffling of packages back and forth. And it's all very, I don't know. It's just all very kind of hushed hush. And you get the feeling that you're watching something exciting, you know, that there will be a thrilling element to this, like a caper or like a noir or something like that. And then the second half completely demolishes that, and you realize, oh my God, that's not what this movie is at all.
Yeah, I agree with that, because honestly, I would say about 10 minutes before the end of part one, like, I'm still trying to figure out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you said, you're getting all this information and names and things like that, but then they kind of start to fill in some of those blanks. And then the second part comes along, and like you said, it takes it to a whole new level.
And that kind of bifurcating, you know, we're assuming you have either seen the movie or you don't necessarily care about spoilers. The hinge that the movie turns on, it becomes a different movie with the death of Anna Magnani's character. I think that's how you say her last name. She was the only star in this movie, really. She was the only actress who had been, not to say that they're all non-professional, but, you know, she's the only face made for the screen, you know, in a way that can justify like a close-up or, you know, what we would think of as a movie star in the 1940s. And it's not a glamorous role. She plays a unmarried pregnant woman, and she's brutally gunned down in the street, you know?
I think that's really, to me, when the movie kind of shifts its tone and lets you know, like, yeah, this is no longer like it. Like, before, you're like, obviously it's about Nazis and there's this like kind of, you're unsettled. It's dealing with a war, et cetera, et cetera. But when she gets gunned down, the movie takes on a completely tonal shift.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a pretty gut-wrenching scene, honestly.
It's gut-wrenching, and it's so shocking when it happens. And it almost shocks you when it actually happens, because it's like, I don't want to say it's a cliched film scene, but it's like she's chasing after, you know, somebody took her son, right? Is that what it is?
No, they took her fiance.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I got that wrong.
Yeah, her fiance she was going to marry the next day, which right. is even fucking worse.
And there's a kind of like cliche of like, okay, she's going to run after him and, you know, scream his name or whatever. And then she just gets unceremoniously gunned down. Like, it's not romanticized at all. You know, it just kind of happens, and it's like, it shocks you, and you're like, oh my God. So this is that kind of movie, right? Like, I mean, Casablanca is about Nazis, but Casablanca's fun, right? You know, because Humphrey Bogart gets one over on the Nazis in the end, you know, like, it's Inglourious Basterds. You know, you think maybe you're watching a movie like that, you know, with maybe a few collateral damage, but boy, we aren't watching a movie like that. You know, it turns brutal really quickly. Yeah. So one of my favorite shots, and I think the turning point of the movie, is the kind of Pietà shot with the priest kind of holding Anna Magnani's character in the street. And I don't want to insult our listeners' intelligence, but for anybody who doesn't know, the Pietà is a famous sculpture by Michelangelo, and I think it's actually a genre of sculpture that would be Mary holding the body of a dead Christ after the crucifixion. And it's known for its kind of pathos and its importance. I was going to say in Christian imagery and Catholic imagery, but just in imagery, you know, in total, this is a motif that has been repeated, you know, probably hundreds of times in the history of cinema and stuff. And in this iteration of it, we have the priest, you know, kind of holding her lifeless body, and it is it's the first shot of the movie that seems composed on purpose, if that makes sense. Everything else feels very like handheld and very like, you know, we're watching stuff go on behind hushed doors and sneaking around and stuff. But then we have this kind of incredibly painful composition. And then that's when we move into the second movie. I don't know. Did that shot impact you as much as it did me? You know, I think that's the kind of hinge point almost.
No. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the priest was in a few scenes that were pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously being probably the first one of the movie. Yeah. Because like you said, up until then, you're kind of just chilling out from one apartment to the next and seeing kids go in and out and families. And there's like I said, there's he switches gears dealing with real life. He did it so well because there's a couple of parts that genuinely make you laugh in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and speaking of the priest and the first act, I'll go ahead and say when he turns the statues.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's that. Like, I was like, this is fucking like this feels so real. It doesn't feel contrived at all. Like he's a priest and like seeing that makes him uncomfortable. And he turns it and it's still uncomfortable. So then he just turns them both away to where they're not looking at each other. And it's fucking hilarious.
He turns the naked statue around and then you just see her ass. And it's like the male statue is just looking directly at her ass. And he's like, all right, I'm going to have to turn the male one around too.
Yeah, it's just it was just a really nice moment. And the dinner scene with the grandfather and the fighting siblings.
Mm.
And all of it just really kind of made you feel like you're in the house and you're part of it. And then as soon as she gets gunned down and the priest holds her, it's like it's more than a tonal shift. It's an everything shift.
That's a good way to put it. It's more than, yeah, you're right. It is. It's more than a tonal shift. It's not to use a fancy word, but it's like an ontological shift. It's like the movie becomes something different after that. It's not just a tonal shift. You're right. That's not even a strong enough word for it. One last thing I want to mention pre-shift is the kids doing the bombing, which I thought was really fun.
Oh yeah, that was great. Yeah.
That was great. The kids just doing little sabotage, you know, and having to hide it from their parents, which is really funny. Yeah, so let's talk about the kind of second half and what that gets into, because the second half is really kind of difficult to watch. And I actually, it's funny, I was thinking of a specific scene that occurs in the second half where the kind of Nazis are just kind of sitting around and, you know, torturing somebody, but then going into the other room. And I remember thinking to myself, like, even like, I don't know, a few months ago or something, like I would think of that scene and I'd be like, what movie is that from? Like, I haven't seen this movie enough times to have it memorized like that. And I was like, what movie is that from? And then when I watched it, I was like, oh my God, that's from this movie. Like it was a scene that had such an impact on me and clearly stuck in my mind, but I couldn't even remember the movie, which is, you know, unusual. But I don't know, break down for us. What exactly happens in the second half of this movie? Because not much happens, but also a lot happens, you know, which is kind of...
Yeah, that's weird. The thing. He spends so much time on the few plot shifts that happen that it makes you feel like a lot's happening. But really, there's only been like two plot pushes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really genius filmmaking, honestly. So essentially the rebels save Manfredi's character.
Mm-hmm.
They get him from the Nazis. He you know, obviously he's aware that his fiance has been gunned down. And he goes to the apartment. There is some relationships that there's a sister involved, but really in terms of the plot, that's not really, we don't even really get to see her reaction
mm-hmm.
to her sister getting gunned down.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting because she was arguing, she was drunk talking about how they got in this fight when she doesn't even know she's dead.
Right.
Which I thought that was a kind of a heartbreaking scene.
Yeah.
But anyway, long story short, he's a well-known bachelor. One of the women he was seeing betrays them straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest and the German deserter They call him a deserter. Really, he's just a Nazi that realized how fucking crazy what they were doing was.
Right.
And they all get taken to the head guy's house. And the girl even asks, like, well, what's going to happen? And she's like, oh, they'll just ask him for information and get it and just let him go. And obviously, we'll get to the part where she sees what happens. But essentially, that's where we spend the rest of our time. We spend the rest of our time in this room with this high-ranking Nazi officer and trying to get information out of these three guys.
Yeah, and one of the guys, the deserter, he hangs himself, I believe, right, in his cell?
Yeah, yeah, he hangs himself.
And then we have, obviously, the priest has to watch the torture of Manfredi, and that's his name, right, Manfredi?
Yeah, I believe
and,
so.
We basically learn that Manfredi is basically kind of like a resistance leader, almost like a Victor Laszlo from Casablanca type character. And they straight up torture this motherfucker. And it's pretty graphic. I mean, you know, not just for the time period, but just period. It's pretty graphic. And honestly, you know, some of these old movies, like, I think the only reason why it wasn't more graphic was just because we didn't have the technology. You know what I mean? Like, we didn't have the same, you know, obviously CGI, but we also didn't have the same, you know, rubber things that could squirt blood and all that shit, you know, and people hadn't thought of that shit yet. So this is, I think, just about as graphic as it could possibly be based on the technology we had to show that stuff.
And yeah. And we're talking blow torches and cutting. Like, it is a rough torture scene considering when it came out. And that's the scene when the woman who betrayed her lover essentially sees his body.
Mm-hmm.
It's beaten and burnt and he's dead and she faints. And that's the last time we see her. But I mean, it's like, yeah, that's like, were you honestly stupid enough to think the Nazis weren't going to kill them? Like, it's just a really frustrating thing to see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we should say the woman that betrayed them, I mean, the woman that betrayed them, obviously, an Italian. I guess that goes without saying. But what did you think about her relationship with the woman who she betrayed her with? Because I don't know if there was kind of like house mother vibes, you know, or if it was kind of a lesbian vibes. You know, that's... At least that's kind of the impression that I got. The way that she is like touching the young woman, and the way that because basically there's this older German woman who convinces the younger Italian woman to betray her friends, and the older German woman is very kind of lecherous. She's this kind of like very masculine, kind of lecherous lesbian type, I feel like. Is, I don't know, did you get those vibes too, or was that just me?
I didn't give their relationship too much thought, but I guess now that you mention it, I'll say, like, a vibe I would get would have to be she's kind of a femme fatale type who can adapt to any situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So maybe she just did what she needed to do, either be this mother role or fill this somewhat of like a subtle lover role to get this woman to do what she needed her to do.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, she's a killer, obviously, this German woman. I mean, she's, you know,
she seems to take it, like, the movie goes out of the way in these like kind of subtle ways to show you that she kind of enjoys what she's doing. I didn't get the feeling that she was sad at all about anything.
Yeah. And we do get a couple of kind of severe close-ups of her in a movie where there's not a lot of close-ups. She's one of the people that we get close-ups of, which I found, I don't quite know what to make of that. It's just really an observation.
Yeah, he was very choosy with what he wanted to focus on. Like, he was very selective, I should say, is what I was looking for.
Yeah, I'm interested
with those shots.
I think the aesthetic changes over the course of the movie, right? The first part is very, you know, cinema verite. It's very like, feels like a man with a movie camera. You know, we're getting these kind of furtive shots of people lining up on street corners, and feels very, it feels very cinematically realist. You know what I mean? It feels very documentary, very Battle of Algiers. If anybody's out there seen that. But the second half is very composed, and there's not a lot of, I don't even think there may not even be one handheld shot in the second half. And it's very, very composed, very orchestrated movement. Like for instance, when we see the torture, there may be a couple of exceptions, but most of the time we are not inside the torture room. We are outside of it. And the reason for that is we are seeing the torture from the point of view of the priest, right? Because they don't really torture the priest. They try to get the priest to convince the others to talk, or they try to get the priest to talk by making him watch the torture. And so that puts us in the audience, that puts him as kind of the audience surrogate in a way. Not narratively, but cinematically, right? Like visually, like we are seeing the torture from his point of view. And that makes it all the more powerful when he just gets fucking executed at the end of the movie, which is obviously what happens after all the torture scenes. Yeah, I don't know where I was really going with that. I guess the change of visual styles, I think, is maybe where I started off.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. There is that. That's something else that kind of shifts from the first act to the second. But the priest did a lot of heavy lifting in the second act, and I liked his interactions with the head Nazi. I like when his reaction when he saw his dead friend, and when he gets shot in the back, you know, he's like, "Forgive them," obviously talking to God, and then. They don't want to shoot him again. I don't know. That scene was really weird to me because the head Nazi, the general or whatever, is like, kill him, finish him off. But none of them lift their guns. He literally, that makes it all the more brutal. He goes over to him, puts a gun to the back of his head, and just pulls the trigger.
Right.
It's brutal. Really fucking brutal.
Execution style. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Execution style as he is... You know, we've talked about this before. There's a couple things that the priests say that we've kind of alluded to in this episode when talking about movies that and just, you know, the kind of cultural imprint that the Nazis left on European, you know, art cinema of the middle of the century. I mean, because it's like, you know, if you're a fan of like old cinema, you can't ignore the fucking impact that these Nazis had on cinema. Like, a lot of America's greatest filmic artists came because they were running away from the Nazis. And then a lot of obviously European art cinema happened in the wake of, or in some cases during, the Nazi occupation. So, I mean, but my point was the priest, you know, he says a couple of things like, that are really interesting, which is one of them. He says, it's not hard to die a good death. It's hard to live a good life. And I thought that was really profound, not just in and of itself, but because he's being led to his death, right? And he is galaxy brained, for lack of a better word. He is insightful and wise enough to realize that he almost has an easy way out, right? Because he gets shot in the back and he gets a bullet in the head. That's a hell of a lot easier than old man Freddy went, you know. And also his troubles are over. You know what I mean? The troubles of the rest of the Italians, you know, having to live under the thumb of this. And that's not to even mention what was going on in, you know, Poland and Germany at the time with the Jews and the Holocaust and all that. Like, you know, it's, I don't know. I found that really powerful. And I also found it really powerful when he's like, forgive them, because this is a guy, you know, when we talk about a Catholic priest here, we're not talking about a representative of a global pedophile ring, right? We're talking about a guy who is dedicated to his ideals, right? Like, who has a certain set of ideals that, and he was based on a real guy, by the way, that character.
Well, that's awesome. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And we're talking about a guy who has a set of ideals that he will not fucking betray, you know, up until the end. And that's, whew, that's tough, man. It is, like you said, it's really powerful, I think.
Well, I have two things to add before we move on. One of which, I'll say this and nothing more. Rossellini did a good job putting me in a position to cheer for a priest. Might be the first time it's ever happened. The other thing is, I love that line you said. I was going to bring it up if you didn't. It, to say it isn't hard to die well, it's hard to live well, plays directly on to the same themes that we went into in detail in the Abel Ferrara episode back on episode 109 with Bad Lieutenant, with these deep religious roots, like I'll die for my country, or I'll die for God, yeah, or whatever.
Right.
It's much easier to die in that moment of glory than to have a life led of humility and purpose and live well. Mm-hmm. And I love that theme. I love that idea. And it was all the more beautiful that it was said by the priest in this situation after we just witnessed his friend get tortured and killed. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess the last thing I'll say about it before we move on is, you know, this is, I feel like we're not getting to the heart of this thing. And of course, we're not, because it's impossible. You can't get to the heart of it unless you just watch the movie, right? Like, all we can do is kind of augment it and maybe be like a sounding board for people who, you know, want to feel like they have friends that they can hear talk about movies. But like, you know, we can't really, you can't really get it unless you see it and you experience it. It's so fucking powerful, man. Like the way that the second half makes it, like, colors the first half of it, because now I'm thinking about events that happened in the first half and they give me more anxiety than when I was actually watching them, because I know what's coming up. Like, when I think about those people arguing in the apartment, it sounds like kind of whimsical and like, oh, all the Italians are arguing with each other, like it's a Fellini movie. And, you know, and then after you watch the movie, you think back to that moment and you go, no, that those are people on the brink, right? Those are people who are feeling such a powerful feeling of anxiety and dread, and they're, I mean, tiptoeing on a volcano is not even the word for it. You know what I mean? They're really living on the edge, and it's goddamn, I don't know. This is just filmmaking on its highest order, you know, and I think very highly of Journey to Italy too. But I mean, this is, I don't know. It's just a damn good movie. And you know, something else too, he also gives screen time to the Germans and gives them, he also gives, I don't want to say a sympathetic German character, but a realistic German character who's like, doesn't buy into any of the bullshit, you know, because the main German guy's like, you are a citizen of the Third Reich, and we are an occupying army, and it's been ratified by international treaties. And he's kind of like drinking the Kool-Aid a little bit. He's convincing himself that he's doing the right thing because it's been verified by some international treaty, or I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. And of course, the priest is having none of it. You know, the priest is answering to a higher order, a higher moral code. But that one Nazi who's just like, we have left a trail of bodies across this continent. Like, we are supposed to be the master race, and we are supposed to bring about this kind of Nazi fantasy of blonde-haired, blue-eyed utopia, you know, and instead we are turning this continent that was the birthplace of the Renaissance and, you know, all these, you know, beautiful architecture and all this stuff. We are turning this continent into a fucking hell on earth. Like, the only thing we're good at is killing and exterminating people. And to see a German character, or I should say a Nazi character, have that self-awareness, and that's another powerful moment. And it almost just happens in passing. It's like the fifth most powerful thing about this movie. Like, he literally is just like coming to the realization, like, oh my God, we're turning Europe into a graveyard. Like, if you think we're doing anything good, like, you're young and naive, you know. It's, I don't know, man. It's just brutal all the way around, and really quite an incredible movie.
No, it is, and what you just said is true. It's going to be something where, like, it needs to be watched again to kind of pick up on these moments. and kind of learn more about what he's trying to do. But you guys should check it out. It's nothing short of fantastic.
So let's turn into let's get into Voyage to Italy, or no, Journey to Italy. I keep saying Voyage to Italy. I want to say my history with this movie is a little bit complicated, because I first got into watching, you know, foreign movies about, I don't know, 12 years ago or 13 years ago, and not a lot of stuff was available on DVD. I used to have the Netflix DVD service, and so I would have to go hunting on obscure websites, you know, for movies. And obviously now there's a lot more of that stuff available, but this was before Criterion ever released Journey to Italy, and back when the English title was Voyage to Italy, because I think the Italian title is Viaggio to Italy, you know, Viaggio being Italian for voyage. And so I watched this on like a really, really subpar. I watched Jean Vigo's La Talente that way too, on a really, really subpar, like 240 pixels, you know, YouTube copy that I'm sure was taken down the next day or something. And I've never gotten back and watching it. When Criterion released it, I was like, I need to get around to watching that. And I just never did, for whatever reason. And so I thought it would be a fun conversation to have. Yeah, I don't know. What did you think about this movie? Obviously, we talked a little bit about it off pod. It wasn't quite as powerful as Rome Open City, which is, I think, completely understandable. But it's a completely different kind of movie. I mean, it's, you know, this is basically about a marriage falling apart, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, like friend of the pod, David Thompson, said, like, Rossellini liked to get into the weeds with real people, real relationships, real things, real life. An examination of a relationship is set with behind this beautiful setting. It's obviously something right in his wheelhouse, but the dangers of that as a viewer is, as we kind of discussed off pod, like you said, is if you don't have a foothold in the real matters and these relationships and people that they're examining, the filmmaker's examining, then you've kind of already lost. And I don't mean to say I didn't like Journey to Italy. I mean to say, like, it was harder for me to be as engaged with a film like this as opposed to Rome Open City.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that. Like, it's just these two. I mean, the synopsis is quick and easy. An unhappily married couple attempts to find direction while vacationing in Naples. Like, that's literally it. You spend time with these people. They snipe at each other. Then they go off and she's touring and he's partying with some people. And the whole movie leaves you in a state of uncertainty. Even the end of it leaves you in a state of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, it's like, Jesus Christ, you motherfuckers should have never got married to begin with. I mean, Jesus, I think at one point Bergman says, I knew like 3 days after we got married, we shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not good, I'll tell you. I can't remember if you said it or not, but he was married to Bergman when they made this movie, and they were divorced shortly after.
Yeah.
So
yeah, their marriage was falling apart in the process of this movie. And this is I think David Thompson has a quote where he says, like, this is a guy who could only process reality once he had captured it through the lens of a camera. And I think that the war trilogy, you know, was a way for him to process what they had just been through in World War II, you know, and specifically Germany Year Zero, I think, was a way for him to process how a European country could do that to another European country, you know. But yeah, Ingrid Bergman basically was like, I called him and had seen, you know, some of his movies, the war trilogy included, and was just like, I have to work with you. You know, I'm sick of this Hollywood bullshit. I, you know, I want to work with a real artist. You seem like a real artist. I want to work with you. And, they got married, and, you know, I think there was debate over whether, like, they should have actually gotten, whether they were really in love, or whether Rossellini just kind of wanted a muse actress life partner, and getting married was just kind of a convenient way to, like, maybe keep her in Italy for that amount of time or something, you know?
Well, I think, Thompson also says that he said, I believe the quote was, she wanted reality and he wanted a star.
Right.
About their relationship, which I think also, you look at another famous Italian director who kind of had the same problem, which is Fellini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now I can't speak to whose relationship was more successful, but I think we can both safely assume from what we've read and watched that their vision as a filmmaker and as an artist greatly influenced the status of their relationship, typically in a negative light opposed to positive.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and we have Godard and Anna Karina, you know, this is a familiar thing to, you know, your male European filmmakers, you know, marrying their muses.
I'm glad that I was trying to keep it all in the family with Italians. And of course you had to bring up the French, but that's okay.
Well, the reason I brought that up is because I see the comparison with Messina is obvious because they're Italian and it's Fellini, but like, also Messina was a real actress. Like, nothing against Bergman, but like, I don't know, like, she's a star, and Anna Karina was a star, you know, but like Giulietta Messina, what I feel like was a, I don't know, she was like a real comedic actress, but I don't know, it doesn't matter.
Well, that is true. I mean, clearly she was, no offense to Bergman, but she was clearly much more talented. She was on a different planet in terms of talent.
Right. Like, she was like a, yeah, I mean, like a clown, and like just the way she, yeah. But yeah, I mean, okay. So what do you make of this? I mean, basically they come to Italy, and I don't know. I'll just say right off the bat, I it's such a simple movie. I think it's 85 minutes long. And then, you know, we basically have them coming and they're kind of experiencing this kind of loneliness together, you know, where they're just like, you know, maybe they're out, obviously they're both successful and they're both whatever, and, you know, presumably upper middle class and living good lives and you know, entertaining people and whatever. And then, you know, they come to this Italian countryside and they really don't have anything to do except for talk to each other, which is really not a good idea. When they start talking to each other, they start sniping at each other. And it's interesting because it's so tempting to like take the kind of post third wave feminism view and be like, this guy's an asshole. And it's like, well, yeah, he's an asshole. And he is. George Sanders' character literally is an asshole.
Oh, he was borderline insufferable.
Yeah. But also Ingrid Bergman is like so tightly wound, right? Like, she's like every interaction they have, she is just like ready to like go off, you know, she's just like a bundle.
That's true. Yeah.
Of like nerves and anxiety. And like, you can see it in his face. He's just like, can you calm the fuck down? You know? And, I don't know. It's really interesting because she, let's start with her because she's trying to have an experience here. She's trying to reconnect with this poet that she used to know, who wrote poetry about being in Rome, right? And, you know, obviously he is interested in reconnecting with these kind of younger women who are, you know, re-entering the picture here, like the one woman with the limp and another woman that he sees just on the side of the street, etc. But she is clearly trying to have some kind of moment, right? Some kind of intense moment of connection with the landscape or with the country or with some of the art that surrounds her. And I think, you know, Roger Ebert has this great quote where he talks about how it is understanding a Douglas Sirk melodrama from the 50s is harder to understand and parse and interpret than it is a Ingmar Bergman movie like The Seventh Seal or something. Because The Seventh Seal is very self-consciously artistic, right? It is signaling to the viewer like, hey, we're dealing with big themes here. Here's a guy playing chess with death, you know. But here, you just have a movie about a couple who are having like marriage difficulties, and it's, I don't know, like what did you make of the, what did you make of the visit to the museum? Right. Because like, yeah, what did you make of the visit to the museum? Because I think there's a lot more going on here than what initially appears to be going on here, if that makes sense.
I mean, I don't know, man. I think if you compare this to a movie like, say, Marriage Story, mm-hmm. where there's like these big fights and these big scenes where they're screaming at each other and furious and drooling with hatred and all that. And then you have this movie where they snipe at each other, but like it's not as showy. You know what I mean? So right. it's more contemplative. So when she's journeying the city and she's going to museums, visiting the catacombs, it's almost to me as if she's discovering how kind of big and beautiful the world is and how much her relationship sucks. But even when I say that out loud, I think that's very reductive and I don't know why.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know. I think this is the kind of movie that rewards multiple viewings. And we should mention too, this is the kind of movie that was not really invented yet, right? The kind of movie where like lonely people like wander around and they're miserable and stuff, you know? I mean, now, you know, I mean, we have stuff like Mad Men where that's a big part of it, but like this kind of like existential movie making where these beautiful people wander around and contemplate the meaning of life is this was not the kind of movie that existed when he made this. So this
it kind of reminded me of that Chloe 9 to 5 movie a little bit.
Right. Cleo. Yeah.
Cleo. Yeah. Cleo 9 to 5. Yeah.
Yeah. It also, I think, was a big precursor to La Aventura, the Antonioni movie. I think we watched that for an episode.
Yeah, we did.
I think it's really similar to that as well. But yeah, I think it's really, okay. Like for instance, that museum scene, right? Like she's quoting the poetry. She wants to go to the museum and she wants to have this like big, you know, moment of revelation. I think what you described, I think that's what she is expecting to have, right? Like she is expecting to, you know, have this connection to this poet that she knew who died young and they were close. And she's expecting to like go into the Italy and like for there to be like this miraculous, like moment of, you know, revelation where she's like a statue is going to come to life and be like, your marriage is a lie, you know, or something like, and instead she is, everywhere she goes, she is just kind of confronted with really annoying tour guides who are like telling her like where to go and okay, you come here. Okay, you come here and go here. And then we're going to go up here. And like these really like annoying male tour guides. And she goes to this museum and there's just all these like hulking, leering statues that are like, you know, dominating the frame. And she looks like overwhelmed. You know what I mean? Like these activities that she's going on are like increasing her anxiety, right? Like the person that she's with in the car is like, oh, look, all the beautiful pregnant women, you know? And she's just got like this fucking panic look on her face, you know? Like she's not reaching some kind of state of rapture. She's like, this shit is like increasing this internal anxiety that she has. It's, I don't know. It's really kind of astonishing to me. That's when I kind of realized that I felt like that was what was going on. Like that's when I texted you and I was like, this movie's on another level, you know? I don't know. What do you think about all that?
I mean, I think it tracks, but it's, I don't know, man. I was so caught up in how insufferable they both were around each other, mm-hmm. that even when she was more relatable in terms of how she reacted to the situations that she was in than he was.
Right.
Because even when he was with other people, like walking that woman with the limp home, hanging out with like the guy playing the guitar, the party scene and stuff, like even then it's like, you're just as annoying now. Like, I don't even understand why these people want to hang out with you. Like you could, like, I can relate to your wife more because I would be annoyed with you after about 30 seconds of interacting with you. Like the scene when he comes home, and she's on the couch and she's like, "Oh, I wasn't expecting you tonight." To me, that's when you really can tell, oh, well, she still has a dog in this fight. And he clearly has left the arena.
Right. Cause she's pretending to be asleep. And then she's like, she calls him in there or whatever, like to have some kind of interaction. He's just like, "Can I go to bed now?" It's like, Jesus, man.
Yeah. Because, and then he's like, "Oh, and I haven't been sleeping well. So have someone call me at 11. I do not want to be disturbed before that." So yeah, I don't know, dude.
No, I definitely think she's more relatable than he is. Yeah, no, I definitely think that's the case. I mean, when we think about, like, you know, her interactions, you know, are kind of like searching for this kind of like epiphany or this like moment in Italy or whatever. And he is just chasing tail the whole time. Like, he is just like, he interacts with that one girl with the limp and she's like, "Thanks for welcoming me home. Like, my husband will be home tomorrow." And he's like, okay. Like, never mind.
Yeah.
And then he like, what did you make of the interaction with him picking up the woman on the street? Because I thought she was a prostitute at first, but I guess, was she? Like, I don't know. How did you read that scene?
I thought she was a prostitute at first too, and I guess she wasn't, or if she did, things did not go how I thought they were going to go. I thought it was just another weird interaction. It's like, I'm thinking at this point, are you just going to try to see how many interactions that you can put this weird motherfucker in to like see how we react to it? Because like the wife is, to me, is having so much more fun than he is.
Is she though? I don't know.
To me, I would rather be visiting catacombs and going to museums contemplating life than doing what he's doing, like personally.
No, okay, that's fair. That's fair. But I don't think she's enjoying herself, maybe.
Oh, yeah, no. She's not having fun. Yeah. I'm just saying what she's doing looks more fun to me.
Certainly, yeah. And she's clearly not just more relatable, but like her head is on the right track, right? At least what she, because, you know, at the end of the movie, she does have kind of a moment of realization, which is the couple in Pompeii, right? Like, seeing the couple who were buried in Pompeii, she has this moment of like, oh my gosh, there is something worth saving in our marriage. You know, there is something, right, that this, this, you know, couple in Pompeii that got, I don't even really know what Pompeii is. It's like an earthquake, like, or like a volcano, and it just killed people instantly. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like that. Yeah. Their ashes were like held in place. Like, yeah, it's pretty interesting.
So like, you know, I think that's, that was kind of like a moment of revelation for her. And so she's like on the right track in the sense that she's like searching in the right place. Whereas he is just like, he's off in La La Land. He's just like having weird interactions. He's on his Don Draper shit is what he's doing.
Yeah, I could see that.
But what did you
think? I agree with that.
What did you think about the ending? What did you think about the ending? And because he kind of has a moment of realization too, and they have a really tentative coming together at the end. Emphasis on, you know, tentative or temporary there, because it certainly doesn't seem like it's going to last. But they do have a moment at the end where they kind of come together in an embrace. After he sees her kind of be carried off in the crowd, that is what sparks something for him.
I'll tell you what I thought of the ending. It pissed me off. I'm not joking. It literally pissed me off. I was flabbergasted by what I was witnessing. There's no way that shit's going to, like, yeah, it's not going to have it lasted 10 minutes after the camera left their lives. Like, I have no faith in that dude to do anything. And it doesn't matter what her feelings were in that moment. I don't buy that Italy reawakened anything. And I feel like once she kind of accepts the fact that, yeah, this isn't meant to be, he's still an insufferable asshole, it's not going to matter. And that might be being too hard on the characters, but I'm sorry. I can only go with what's presented to me. I can only go by what I'm being shown.
I mean, this is coming from someone. I have no problem telling you when I think you're being too cynical about the end of a movie, but I don't think you're off the mark at all. I think that's, it's almost inherent. The way that they so quickly kind of come together at the end, and the way that she has that revelation, right? Like it's a revelation, right? It is a moment, right? You know, we have these moments, right? Like the first time I saw the Westminster Cathedral, right? Like I cried, okay? Because I was just in awe of how beautiful it was. And it was the first time I'd ever been in Europe. And it was just kind of like, it was just mind blowing to me. Now, that didn't last, right? It's not like I came home and converted to the Anglican Church or something, or like decided I was going to live in London. It had no lasting effect on my life, right? It was just a moment that I had in time, and then it was gone, right? And that is similar to like what I feel like the moment in this movie is. Like she has this kind of moment, and he barely even fucking responds to it, man, which is, ooh, buddy. I mean, he's just a cold human being, you know?
Yeah, and, man, he's checked out. I mean, he's been checked out.
Yeah. And then he kind of has a similar moment in the sense that he has a moment where he sees her being carried away by the crowd. And that is when he kind of like reaches out for her and begins to kind of check back in. But like you said, just because he begins to check back in, quote unquote, for lack of a better word, I guess, check back in for a particular moment. And the way she says something, you know, she says something and he's like, are you promised you won't take advantage of me? And it's like, oh, this is not like lasting change. Like this is a moment in time, you know? And like, that doesn't mean it's fake or anything, or like it's somehow inauthentic. It just means that it's a moment. It's the definition of the word moment, right? It's not going to last, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this movie's a masterpiece. I you know, Rossellini was a highly theoretical filmmaker, and by that I mean he would sketch out these kind of ideas or theories and then try to make movies that would live up to them, I guess, in a way. Like he has some really obtuse quotes that yeah, and this is something that happens with, and maybe it has something to do with the translation, who knows, but this is something that happens with some filmmakers, like Godard is a perfect example, and Eisenstein is maybe the first example ever of the type of filmmaker who will, and Tarkovsky did this too, Robert Bresson did this as well, where they would write out their kind of like thesis statements, or like what they believed that cinema was capable of, or what they believed they were doing with their camera or with cinema or whatever. And then they would try to live up to them, right? And sometimes that shit is indecipherable. In fact, I think more often than not, it's indecipherable. And for somebody else to try to look at it and get inspiration or look at it as a key to understanding their work, I think you're barking up the wrong tree, because I think it's just, it was a way for them to cross the bridge to making the work, and not a way for us to cross the bridge and interpret it. But I just think it's worth pointing out that he thought a lot about this shit, right? Like David Thompson also talks about the shadow of the camera, the shadow of the camera, being visible in the last shot of the movie, you know, as an indication that this is realistic, you know, and also that he needed to process the events that were happening in his life through the camera, right? And that is something I will really admire Rossellini for. I think he's, you know, like even when they enter the hotel, right? Everything is unsettling. This whole movie is unsettling. I don't know if you remember this. They enter the hotel and they go to the right, which is clearly where the check-in desk is. And they check in. He goes, yes, sir, right this way. And he walks them to the opposite side of the lobby. And then he goes to this grand staircase And instead of going up this grand staircase, they go up this little tiny elevator that is right beside the grand staircase. And little things like that happen in within the architecture of the scenes, right? That are really, really fascinating to me. Like when they go to the party and there's like a fucking count and Contessa and the princess of whoever, and they're all at this, you know, fancy party, but like, it looks like they're going to like an underground gambling den. Like the outside of it is so run down and they get into this rusty elevator and, I don't know, just like little things like that. That is, you know, that is film directing at its highest level. I think it's telling you things and communicating things to you visually through the objects that are on screen, through the way that people are moving on screen, to the extent that almost the characters and what they say or whatever are beside the point. It's not actually beside the point, but it's, I don't know. I just think he's a genius, and yeah, I love this movie. I think it's incredible, and I think you should watch it again is what I think. I think you should give it like 6 months. You should watch this again. And because I think you would find yourself less annoyed, because the first time I watched this, I was just like, oh, it's supposed to be a good movie. Okay, cool. Yeah, they broke up. All right, whatever. But like second time around, I feel like it clicked in for me, you know?
Well, I mean, I'm going to watch more of his films, and clearly we'll do another episode, and then I will rewatch this one to kind of get a better grasp of it. But I mean, I will definitely agree to the fact that, yeah, he's a genius, and I can't wait to watch more of his movies.
I'll tell you this, I won't be rewatching Rome Open City anytime soon. That's a tough watch, man.
That one's just too heavy. Yeah, I agree. But aside from that, I mean, guys, if this wasn't enough to convince you, I don't know what is, but go watch these movies. Go watch more of Rossellini and just kind of see his Italian genius.
Yeah, he's great. And yeah, glad I picked him. We'll have to delve further into the War trilogy maybe next time.
Yeah, I'm really glad you picked him, because this was a blind spot that I'm glad to kind of fill in. So, no. But aside from that, do you have anything to add before we wrap it up?
No, man. Let's wrap it up.
Guys, thanks for listening. Don't forget, hit us up on Twitter, Instagram, any of that, to let us know your thoughts. So, anyway, guys, we will see you next week at the Silver Screen video.